Weather. I'm really sorry that we've had to put you through this sunshine and warm temperatures, so my apologies. It's great to see so many people from all over Canada. Who here is from Ontario? Oh my. Anyone from Hamilton? So that's where I'm from originally. Yep. I grew up in Hamilton, went to Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, and found my way here to Kelowna. So welcome everybody. Anyone from Nova Scotia? My wife's from New Glasgow. There we go. When we got married in Cape Breton. So there you go. Yeah. So I love to get across the country and speak at events like this and get to meet everybody across the country and really talk about naturopathic medicine. And the reason that I'm here today is to talk about how naturopathic medicine and what the role of a naturopathic doctor can be in treating celiac disease and the whole spectrum of non-celiac gluten sensitivity as well. So I'm Dr. Brent Barlow. I practice here in Kelowna, as Bruce said, just down the street at the Kelowna Wellness Clinic. And I got control. I forgot about that. So today what I want to talk about is, as I understand, I'm the first naturopathic doctor to ever speak at the celiac convention. So I want to give a bit of background on what it is that we do as a profession. Talk about celiac disease, the sensitivities, the allergies, and how we interpret all that together. Talk about the pathogenesis and associated conditions. Talk about the diagnosing and testing. I think there's some new options out there that we're not all familiar with right now. And talk about conventional treatment and how naturopathic treatment should integrate in with the conventional treatment as well together, so that it is an integrative system, not one versus another. So a naturopathic doctor, we're licensed in the province of British Columbia and many provinces and many states in the United States as primary healthcare physicians, which means we're licensed to both diagnose and treat medical conditions. We typically take a holistic approach, which means that we're not focused and dialed in on one aspect, but we want to look at how does nutrition affect your health? How does stress affect your health? How does the digestive system maybe affect the heart disease that you have? So that we're looking at the whole body, not just minor aspects of what you come in and present with. We do everything that we do based on evidence, based on research and empirical evidence. And that's one of the big misnomers that is out there about naturopathic medicine or complementary and alternative medicine, is that there just isn't the research or the evidence behind some of the things that that people might be doing. And what we really pride ourselves in doing is following the research and following the evidence and trying to build that body even more. As a naturopathic doctor, we have 8 years of post-secondary education, so a four-year undergrad degree and then 4 years of naturopathic medical school. So very much on par with medical school, dental school, chiropractic medical school as well. Just different trains and different focuses. And basically, as a naturopathic physician, we focus a lot on the core therapies of working with nutrition, working with lifestyle, working with vitamins and minerals, botanicals, amino acids, a lot of natural substances. But in the province of British Columbia, we also have prescription rights, so we can work with most pharmaceutical medicines as well. And also in the province of BC, as many other jurisdictions, we have the ability to use intravenous therapies and injection-based therapies as well. So that makes up a big part of my practice too. I always put this slide in any presentation that I do because to me this is who I am and who we are as a profession. And I think for the most part, when you're in healthcare, this is really what we all do in healthcare. Number one, first do no harm. So that's the first part of all of our oaths, is to make sure that we're not doing anything to actually harm a patient. And that's where it's really important to know what medication someone's taking, what conditions they have that might predispose them to something, to really first do no harm. The second is treat the cause. And as all of you know here with celiac disease, it can be a long road to find out what's causing your health concerns. On average, about 10 years before an accurate diagnosis is made. So what we want to do is try and speed up that process and try, every time a patient comes in, find out what is actually causing their health ailments and how do we treat that cause. Number three, the healing power of nature. This to me is very important. We want to work with the body. The body does want to heal. It wants to recover. And we want to remove the things that are preventing it from healing and recovering and work with that system. Just like when we have a cut, when we're cooking in the kitchen, our body we'll want to heal that cut. Well, when we have a cut or damage in the intestinal lining, if we can help and encourage the body to heal that, that's really what we want to do. Number four, treat the whole person. You know, if you come in with cardiovascular disease, let's look at your nutrition. Let's look at stress. Let's look at the digestive system. Let's not just look at the heart itself. Doctor is teacher. Doctor is a Latin word that means teacher. So a big part of our job as physicians is to go out and educate and empower people. And hopefully when you leave a presentation like this, you have more knowledge on how your body works and on what you can do to improve your overall health. So I think that's a huge role of a physician. And number six, focus on prevention. We don't want to just help you with the current medical problem that you have. We really want to work on making sure that you're healthy long-term and preventing these types of issues or new issues from coming up down the road. So enough about naturopathic medicine and integrative medicine, but I felt that was really important for me to get across because that's really what I do and how we work here in Kelowna with so many physicians and other practitioners in an integrative model. So what I want to talk about as far as celiac disease is put these into four categories here and say, category one is celiac disease. Category two is a grain allergies, and we have a few different subsets of allergies that people can suffer from. Type three is a grain intolerance, and type four is a grain sensitivity. So I'll go into detail with all of these, but I just wanted to lay that out as the four main topics. So celiac disease, as we all know, and I'll go more briefly through this, you know, the gluten molecule is initiating an immune response in the intestine. We're getting inflammatory damage, and we're getting elevated tissue levels of the tissue transglutaminase enzyme. So that's typically what we're looking for and what we see in the pathology of celiac disease. Whereas when we have food allergies, and this is what I think was being mentioned earlier about the different types of food allergies, we've got two main ones that we look for. Type one, which is called an immediate sensitivity reaction. And immediate sensitivity reactions are the type of allergy that most of us typically think of when we hear allergy. You know, you have hay fever or the kids who have peanut allergies where they swell up and go into anaphylaxis. These are mediated by immunoglobulin E and by histamine. And they tend to have an immediate reaction, you know, within minutes after exposure. And they tend to be very acute and strong reactions. Although I'll show you a test coming up in a few minutes that will go through the varying levels of immunoglobulin E and histamine reaction so that they're not all anaphylactic. Many of these reactions are lower grade models. So that's the first type of allergy. The second type of allergy is very, very common. And this is what we're really trying to look for in my field. And this is the type 2 delayed sensitivity reaction. And type 2 means that it's mediated by immunoglobulin G and sometimes immunoglobulin A. So these are different immune proteins that the immune system makes to attack something, different than immunoglobulin E. They typically happen in a delayed fashion, anywhere from 2 to 48 hours after exposure. And this can explain why so many people have chronic issues, but they can't tie it in with their food. They ate breakfast and they didn't get sick right away, but they feel very lethargic and very tired and poor digestion hours and hours later or even a day later. That's usually this type of allergy. And they're more chronic inflammatory symptoms. And if you look at many of those symptoms, they can fit in with a celiac picture, very, very much so. The third type here is an intolerance. And this is something a lot of patients come in and they say, I think I'm allergic to dairy or I think I'm allergic to corn or something like that. And what they actually mean is that they're having an intolerance. They're lacking an enzyme to break it down. And as we all know, the gluten molecule, just like casein in dairy, can be very hard molecules to digest and break down. So many times these aren't actually allergies, but they're an enzyme deficiency or an inability to digest and break down the food particle or protein. So that's typically what an intolerance is. There's really no immune system involvement at that level. Often you get an immediate response. So if you think about someone who's lactose intolerant, they have a glass of milk, they have some yogurt, they have something like that, they typically react pretty much right away. They can feel it going on in their digestive system. So that's more of a typical picture. And the third area here is something where it's the realm of the unknown. It's just called a sensitivity. We don't really know what it is. It's not celiac. It's not a food allergy by IgE or IgG or IgA. It's not an intolerance. We just don't know exactly what it is, but it does seem to exist, and hopefully someday we'll know more what it is. But we don't have an immune system involvement. We have, could be immediate, could be delayed, could be acute, could be chronic. It really is the realm of the unknown. So we try and rule everything else out before we label something as a sensitivity. So the pathogenesis and associated conditions. How many people here have heard the term leaky gut syndrome? Is that it's a pretty common term. And some people really believe a lot in leaky gut syndrome. Some people think it's controversial. Some people don't like that term or the name of it. But basically, you know, as we were talking, you know, earlier and definitely yesterday as well, when you have inflammation in the GI tract and you have inflammatory damage going on, what happens is the villi start to break down. And the small intestine cells should be super tight. They only allow what they want to pass through because the bonds are very, very tight between these cells. But when you get inflammatory damage and you start to break down the structure and the integrity of the intestinal lining, now larger protein molecules can leak through. So these large molecules start to leak through, and either at the villi or once they cross over, the immune system starts to react. And you get what's called antigen-antibody complexes. Has anyone heard of antigen-antibody complexes before? A few, yeah. So the picture at the bottom there basically shows an antigen, which is basically something that causes an allergy or something that causes an immune response. So that big circle is the antigen, and the antibody are those Y-shaped things. So those are proteins that the immune system is making to attack that antigen. And basically, when those complexes form, that's your inflammatory response. And they cause damage not only in the villi and in the small intestine, but if they do leak through to the bloodstream, they'll go systemically and end up in your joints, in your kidneys, in the eyes. And that's why so many chronic systemic systems seem to happen with these types of conditions. Whether it's celiac, whether it's an allergy, a sensitivity, they all can have the same kind of mechanism where these antigen-antibody complexes form and then cause inflammatory damage. So the associated diseases and conditions, you know, we won't talk too much about this, but these are the things that make you start to become suspicious that something is going on, all the GI conditions. The most common reason people come in to see me is digestive. You know, I'm experiencing chronic gas and bloating, or I've chronic cramping or heartburn. So common in our society. And, you know, we really want to try and figure out what's actually causing that. Skin conditions. We see this all the time, especially in children. Eczema, psoriasis, for what seems to be unknown reasons, but it seems to be traced back to nutrition and what's coming in their body and the inflammatory damage that's going on in the GI tract. Pain, that's probably the second most common reason people come in to see me is for chronic pain, and nutrition can really play a role in that. Systemic issues, just feeling tired, anemic, not digesting food properly, so you're deficient in those nutrients. And mental emotional disorders. A number of people come in with anxiety, depression, and it relates back to the inflammation going on in their GI tract. So the diagnosis, I've got two slides here. This is sort of the typical pathway for diagnosis for most people. About, you know, a few years, maybe more of, you know, something might be going on, and at some point your physician starts to say, the clinical symptoms might look like celiac disease. Let's do a test for it. And so obviously there's some pros and cons to basing a diagnosis on clinical symptoms, because we seem to miss it so often and we seem to have such a delayed response to it. The serological testing or blood testing, the tissue transglutaminase, it right now seems to be the best test to find for celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. But you can also test for immunoglobulin A and immunoglobulin G against gliadin, which is not something that's really being done a lot, but that can be done. And then the biopsy is the gold standard. And how many people in the room here have had the biopsy done and... I'm not done the question yet. but had the biopsy done, and you go through this period of eating gluten and eating wheat, and it's not a pleasant period. You know, so you might have gone for a while saying, I think I've got celiac or I've got gluten sensitivity, so I'm going to go off of gluten. You start feeling better, but then to get the accurate test, to get the biopsy or the blood test, you go back onto your gluten containing diet and really put yourself through the ringer for a few months and then get that test. So there's definitely some pros and cons to going through all those steps, but really the definitive diagnosis is the biopsy. The second slide is a bit more my approach to the diagnosis. We definitely want to look at clinical symptoms. And when you're a physician who's aware and really looking for celiac disease, you're going to look for it sooner. So you're hoping that people aren't going 10 years under your supervision without doing proper testing. You're hoping that you pick it up as soon as possible and not allowing it to continue. The type of blood testing that I do, I look at food allergies, and I'm going to show you guys a test here, a couple tests in a few minutes, but we look for immunoglobulin E, we look for immunoglobulin G, we look for immunoglobulin A, and we look for tissue transglutaminase, and we put it all together so that we're not just looking for celiac disease and that's it, but we're looking for all these other subsets and spectrums of celiac and of non-gluten sensitivity. And food elimination can be one way to find out, are you sensitive? If you test negative for all these other things, yet you go on a gluten-free diet and you feel better, to me and to many professionals, that is a test in itself. That can give us a lot of good information. And then the biopsy. It is the gold standard to actually diagnose that type of damage going on in the intestine. So Adam, if we can throw up the PDF of that first test, we're going to show you, these are actual patients of mine. We've taken the names away so that it's confidential. But I want to walk you through a couple tests to show you what is available. And there are several labs in North America running these types of tests. The lab that I predominantly use for this type of test is in Vancouver. So this is a patient. I know it's a little small. We can blow it up. But just in general here, this is a food allergy test that's testing for immunoglobulin G. So the type 2 delayed sensitivity reaction. And we're testing about 100 foods. So this is the basic panel. And you'll see the dairy, egg section. You'll see beans, nuts, and seeds, the meats and seafoods. On the right-hand side, there's fruits and vegetables. Everything looks good. Green means good. All those small numbers means we're producing very small amounts of immunoglobulin G. So we're really not having an inflammatory response. One thing showed up on this patient's test, and this is a 37-year-old male, and he's been diagnosed with Sjogren's disease. And Sjogren's disease is an autoimmune condition. But his blood markers, the anti-nuclear antibodies, were not elevated. It was a diagnosis of exclusion. They didn't know what it was. They think it's Sjogren's. And what happens in Sjogren's disease is you tend to have very dry mouth. You build up stones in the salivary glands. And it's an autoimmune condition, so nobody really knows what causes it. And it can be difficult to diagnose. So they think he might have Sjogren's disease. So when this test came back, wheat was the only thing that showed up. So we said, we should take a look here and see if there's something deeper going on. When you look at the test, you'll see that we also test for rye and for barley, and we can test for other gluten-containing grains. So he's not making an immune response for these other grains, just wheat. So if we show the second one, this is the expanded panel where we're running three more tests to find out what is going on. And if we can maybe blow it up just a bit. Thank you. So the first test here is anti-gladin IgA. And you'll see that number is positive. On the right-hand side, it says POS, meaning positive. And what that means is IgA is typically produced in the mucous membranes. So the eyes, ears, nose, throat, any kind of opening to the body. To the outside world. And so that showed up positive. And to us, that explained a lot about the Sjogren's types of symptoms, the salivary gland issues. When we ran the tissue transglutaminase, that's the second test there, you'll see on the right-hand side it says negative. So he doesn't have celiac disease according to this test. We can still run a biopsy to see, you know, if he does there. But the tissue transglutaminase is negative. And then we look at the very bottom, and that's the IgE to wheat. And you'll see he's in category 4. And category 4 is kind of in the moderate level of IgE reaction. So he's not experiencing acute histamine IgE response. It's not anaphylactic. It's not to that level. But he's experiencing a real strong reaction to wheat. And the other symptoms that this patient is experiencing is swelling and redness all through his legs, cellulitis. The doctors, his health team, really don't know what's going on. So when we got these tests back, we prescribed a gluten-free diet. And all over the last, over about a month and a half, everything started to go away, start to get much, much better. So at the end of the day, how do you treat most of this stuff? It is the gluten-free diet, but at least we can categorize and figure out what's going on. Typically what will happen and what I've seen with so many people is you test negative for tissue transglutaminase, and now you're left saying, well, you know, what else do I do? Where do I go from here? But having these types of tests available can really help us categorize and say, you know, you don't have celiac, but we do have these other reactions going on to whether it's wheat or rye or some other protein, some other molecule in these other grains. So this could be extremely valuable, and it's helped change his life immensely. And if we go to the third lab test, or third PDF, this is a test of someone who does have celiac disease. And the reason I wanted to show this test is because you'll see in the very top, that's the dairy and egg section, this person's having an extreme reaction to many different forms of dairy. So we look at Swiss cheese. We look at eggs, both the egg white and egg yolk. We look at cow's milk, cottage cheese, cheddar cheese, even butter. So you can be celiac and have food allergies to other foods. And I see this all the time. It's not necessarily just the gluten that's reacting to the system. But often we have a problem with eggs, spinach, garlic, corn, soy, could really be anything. So if all we do is go on a gluten-free diet, we might be missing some other real key things. So you might get significantly better, but never get over the hump because you're still eating other foods that are causing a reaction. And if we, Adam, if we can go to the bottom right there, what I wanted to do is just show the results at the bottom there. And you'll see that we've tested total IgE, the tissue transglutaminase, the gluten IgE, and the wheat IgE. And the only one that showed up positive is tissue transglutaminase. So typically this patient would be diagnosed with celiac disease and prescribed a gluten-free diet, and that would be the ultimate treatment. But for us, and I think where we're going as we go further and further with the knowledge that we have, is that we'll look for other food allergies and find out that this person is not handling dairy very well at all. So not only do they have celiac disease, but they have a situation with dairy that they need to avoid at least for a certain period of time, if not lifelong, depending on how it's actually affecting him over time. And we can go back to the PowerPoint. So I'm thinking that this type of testing is probably new for most people. Has anyone seen this type of testing before? One, two. So a fair number of people, but not this will be new stuff for a lot of people. So this type of testing is available all across Canada. It's available across North America. It's being done by private labs and major private labs. So if you have any questions afterwards, we can definitely talk more, and I can let you know across Canada and Ontario who you might want to speak to for this type of testing if it's valuable for you. So the conventional treatment, and I hope that nothing I'm saying here is at all putting my field against any other field. To me, being a physician, being in healthcare, we're all in it together for one reason, and the reason is for the patient's best interest. You know, I'd like to be part of an integrative health world where we're all being hired by the patient to really act in their best interest, give the best advice to them, and help them get better and better. And it's not about what we do as healthcare professionals, it's about the needs that the patients have and how we can fill those needs. And typically what happens in our world is that for years, the diagnosis kind of gets overlooked. And I think we're getting better as physicians in being quicker at finding these, but we still have a lag in the time. The gluten-free diet is typically it's the best treatment. If you have celiac, if you have any of these spectrums, you want to go gluten-free. But is it the only diet? And then the other treatments that sometimes get used are anti-inflammatory medications, surgeries, And part of what I want to say today is that if we don't get fully better after going gluten-free, there's likely something else going on. Either we haven't healed properly, or we have other food allergies or other things that we need to investigate and find. And that's where we see a lot of people kind of, they go gluten-free and think that, you know, this is it. This is all I need to do. But often we need to do a bit more to fully heal and recover. So there's four aspects of naturopathic treatment that I want to talk about today. One being diet, the next being what supplements can we take, the third being intravenous therapies, and the fourth being acupuncture. The goals that I have when I'm working with someone in nutrition, there's really three main goals. I want to put together a personalized nutrition plan, probably just like the dietitians, nutritional consultants who work with patients as well. We want this to be individualized and really work for each person. There's no one standard diet that works for all of us because we all have different levels of tolerance to sugars, tolerances to other grains and other nutrients. So it should be individualized. We really want to empower people, give knowledge. I'm sure everybody here who's gluten-free has figured out how hard it was in the very early stages to go gluten-free. And we're very fortunate that we have more and more support from more restaurants, more grocery stores, and food suppliers now than ever before. But it's a hard world to enter when you go gluten-free. So a big job as a naturopathic physician or a dietitian, nutritional consultant is not to say, you know, let's eat a gluten-free diet and I'll see you in 6 months. But let's help you. Let's give you the resources and empower you so that you know how to do that. And the biggest resources is join the Kelowna Celiac Association. and then, you know, give the tools and solutions. So often we don't want to just go gluten-free. There's often other things that we want to avoid. But when we get a lot of the packaged foods, we'll find that, you know, person thinks that they're going gluten-free, but there's actually hidden sources of gluten coming in there. It's amazing how many people don't know that soy sauce has wheat in it. You know, or things that maybe all of us in the room were very familiar with, but when you first enter that world, you just don't know, and you need that extra support. So we help people go gluten-free and really truly gluten-free. We help them go off of their other food allergies if they have them. Not every celiac patient has other food allergies, but many do, and we want to help you get off of those as well. And we want to make sure that you go off of the digestive system irritants. So things that might be bothering the digestive system. A good example would be somebody diagnosed with diabetes who switches from drinking, you know, Coke to Diet Coke. You know, that might be okay from the standpoint of you're getting less sugar, but what about the aspartame? What about the other, you know, irritants coming into to the GI tract and into the body? So when you go to a celiac diet, a gluten-free diet, we want to make sure that you're not just eating French fries and ketchup and what's the other good stuff? You know, we want to make sure you're getting a true, whole, well-rounded diet, and we're not getting lots of preservatives and stuff like that, which can often come in with a very highly processed diet. I think there's three real big aspects of nutrition that I wanted to touch on today. One being timing. And the reason timing is so important is it's important for your blood sugar. We really want you to have nice, stable blood sugar, nice, stable insulin response. But we also want to be kind to the digestive system, especially in those first few months or first year after a diagnosis of celiac, because there's a lot of inflammatory damage that needs to heal and needs to repair once you go gluten-free. So eating typically more 4 to 6 small meals or snacks in a day is going to be much kinder to your intestinal villi than having 3 large meals a day or having 2 large meals a day. And spreading those out, you know, every 2 to 4 hours so your blood sugar isn't on this big up and down roller coaster type of thing. Last meal by 7:30. The later we eat, the later we delay the release of growth hormone in our body. So if we're going to bed at 10, 10:30, something like that, if we have our last meal by 7:30 at night, 2 hours into sleep, we're going to kick out our growth hormone or kick it up, and we're going to have nice growth hormone release all through the night if we're sleeping well through the night. If we eat at 10 o'clock at night, go to bed at 10:30, we're going to delay our growth hormone release and have a much shorter window for growth hormone. And growth hormone is so important in repairing damaged tissue. So that's why that's so important. Portion control. That relates a lot to the timing. We want to make sure we're not just throwing huge meals into our system and saying, oh, I'm going to hope for the best with digestion. Let's be kind to that tract as it's healing. and mental emotional. It's amazing, you know, we're in a hustle bustle society. You know, people from Ontario might think that Kelowna is a laid back, you know, kind of BC town, but everywhere is stressful and people eat on the run. People, you know, have business meetings while they're eating. This type of stuff really decreases our digestion and absorption. So when you are recovering after diagnosis and you're going gluten-free, it's important to take your time, chew your food, not have arguments, not have stress around food, and to really allow that repair and full digestion and absorption to happen. So I think those are crucial. Obviously, going gluten-free is the number one thing. There's no doubt about that. But we find that it works so much better if you incorporate these types of things with being gluten-free as well. Nutritional supplementation. People ask me all the time, what can I take for this? What can I take for that? Well, number one, it all depends on what's causing the issues. We want to treat that cause. But there's a few different categories that I want to talk about. So the first category here is GI rebuilding. And there's four supplements here that can really help rebuild and repair the damage that's in the intestinal system. The first one being glutamine. I'm sure most of you have heard of L-glutamine before. It's an amino acid, and it's a primary fuel for the cells of the intestines. They love glutamine. They will gobble it up, and they'll use it like crazy to rebuild. Glutamine is a major supplement for bodybuilders. So if you go into most gyms, you'll see these huge tubs of glutamine. And there's also a huge connection between Crohn's and ulcerative colitis and bodybuilding, or playing football, playing these sports where you're really trying to build. If you have a limited amount of glutamine in your system and you're pushing your muscles, the muscles will steal it from the intestinal cells, or there'll be this competition and the intestinal cells often will lose out, and then you have inflammatory bowel conditions because the cells are not able to keep their integrity. So one of the main ways we can rebuild after damage like this is using glutamine. And typically we'll use it for anywhere from 3 to 6 months to rebuild. Essential fatty acids, the omega-3s, specifically from fish oil, and the EPA molecule in the omega-3, really great for the cells of the small intestine. They love that almost as much as glutamine for energy, and it helps to decrease inflammation in the system as well. Vitamin C is crucial for connective tissue repair. So you can imagine these tight bonds that are between the cells of the small intestine. What's holding all that meshwork together is connective tissue, collagen fibers. And vitamin C is required to lay down new collagen fibers. So as the villi start to repair, we need to make sure we're not deficient in vitamin C so we can repair proper connective tissue. And probiotics. Probiotics is the use of Acidophilus, Bifidus, the good bacteria. There's actually more cells of bacteria in our digestive tract than our own cells. So there's more of them in us than us in us, if that makes sense. So we basically give them home. We say, you guys can live here, but we want you to keep it clean, keep it neat and tidy, kill anything that tries to get in. They do a lot of work that we think our immune system is doing. And they work very tightly with our immune system. So that first word there, prevent dysbiosis. That's kind of a weird term, dysbiosis. But what it means is we have an imbalance of good bacteria to bad bacteria, or bacteria to yeast. And what we really want to do is make sure we got the good guys there, because they will do a lot of work and take a lot of load off of our immune system and prevent a lot of damage if we've got the good guys there. So typically all four of those we would use for about 4 to 6 months in conjunction with the gluten-free diet and healthy lifestyle, and in order to rebuild the GI system. The next category for supplementation is the digestive system support. So this is something that we'll use a lot when we're just not digesting food properly. So you know when you eat the big meal, it's like, oh, this is just not going down properly. Well, a lot of times what happens is we're very low in stomach acid. And I know this is a controversial topic, because most of us who think about heartburn and acid reflux will think, well, let's go with Tums, let's go with an antacid. So I know this is kind of controversial, but for many people, they have deficient stomach acid. The stomach is basically very acidic, and it should be very acidic in order to do three main things. Break down the proteins that we ingest, kill any kind of microorganism like bacteria, virus that comes in, and activate enzymes that the pancreas makes. If we don't have an acidic stomach, we don't do these things very well at all. Now, the problem with heartburn and acid reflux is that acid starts to spill up to the esophagus and cause pain and cause damage. And over the long term, that can really increase your risk for esophageal cancers and things like that. So it's extremely dangerous to, you know, run around with heartburn and acid reflux for long periods of time. We really don't want to do that. But what we really want to do is make sure that the valve between the stomach and the esophagus closes down properly. So acid reflux, in my view, is not so much about too much stomach acid. It's about the valve not closing down properly and allowing acid to spill back up. So that's how we would treat that, is by working with the valve itself. I think I'm off on a bit of a tangent here, but the digestive system often will use hydrochloric acid or stomach acid to help improve your digestion. We'll often use digestive enzymes. And I'm sure many of you take digestive enzymes before meals, but often what will happen is people are low in stomach acid, they take enzymes, and the enzymes just don't seem to work. They're okay, but they just don't seem to work that well. And a lot of times it goes back to the acid. And then demulcents. So if you are experiencing heartburn and reflux, in the period of time when we're trying to increase your stomach acid, we can use demulcents, the most important one being deglycerated licorice, or DGL. What that does is coat the lining of the esophagus and stomach and prevent the acid burn and acid reflux from acid being spilled back up. So we can do this in a safe manner. So these things can really help the breakdown of our nutrients so that we can break them down properly and then absorb them properly. Optimal health support. You know, many people, when you have celiac or non-celiac gluten sensitivities, anemia, fatigue, poor sleep, all these things. And a lot of it can come back to the fact that we're just not getting enough nutrients into our body. Basically, everybody on the planet here could be taking a multivitamin, multimineral. It's very, very hard, if not impossible, to get optimal levels of our vitamins and minerals from our diet, even as good as it can be. So a good multivitamin, multimineral, to me, is worth its weight in gold. Vitamin D. And the research has been outstanding in the last 10 years about how in North America, in Canada, we're just deficient in vitamin D. I have a 13-month-old son. He's the cutest in the world, by the way. You know, right from day one, the recommended dose for infants is 400 IUs of vitamin D. Not too long ago, that was the recommended dose for adults. So in the last 10 years, we've gone from an adult dose being 400 IUs to now we're putting infants right from the first day that they're born on 400 IU because of all the research that's been shown what vitamin D does. And just as a side with vitamin D, it's actually being referred to more and more in the literature, in the textbooks, as hormone. Vitamin D is more of a hormone than it is a vitamin because it's so essential for communication between cells. And that's how white blood cells use it to fight off cancers and to fight off other conditions, is this white blood cell sends a signal to another one, and vitamin D plays a big role in that communication. A B complex can be really important when we're under high levels of stress. We're using lots of B vitamins to try and produce energy, so it can be really important for that. Calcium, magnesium, to nice, strong, healthy bones, very important for our cardiovascular system and our musculoskeletal system as well. And a green drink. You know, most of us still have trouble getting enough fruits and vegetables in the day. So by no means do I think this is mandatory for everybody at all, but a green drink can be a great way to get a lot of extra vegetables and fruits and plant-based nutrients into our diet, get it in a very digestible and absorbable form. You know, if we can have one or two good liquid meals in a day, and I don't mean going for some Okanagan wine, but can really help. One caution, though, is many green drinks actually have gluten in them. So typically, if you're celiac, it's better to make your own fresh or find a supplier where it's gluten-free. But they're hidden in a lot of the products, so that's just a caution. A couple other areas of supplementation that may be helpful for people who have celiac disease is the adrenal gland. Who here has heard of the adrenal glands before? Okay, almost everybody. Okay, good. The adrenal glands, they live above the kidneys. They're attached to the kidneys. They produce our stress hormones. And they also produce our sex hormones as well. They're not the primary producers of sex hormones, but they do play an important role, especially as we age and for women going into menopause and for men getting older and going into andropause, if you believe in that or if that exists. The adrenal glands, when you're under stress, and especially any kind of stress that's coming on the body, nutritional or situational, the adrenal glands are making a lot of stress hormones. As they wear down, we start to wear down. So if fatigue is a big issue, the adrenal glands might be a huge area that we need to work with. So I wanted to put that up there for us. Anemia, one of the probably the most common associated condition with celiac disease is anemia. And typically it's iron deficiency, but there could also be B12 or folic acid deficiency in the anemia. What we see a lot is ferrous sulfate, you know, 300 milligrams three times a day, you know, high levels of iron in a very poor absorbable form, causing constipation, causing other digestive issues. What we use is a much more absorbable form. There's a couple other forms of iron that you can use that are much more easily tolerated by the GI tract and much better absorbed. So in my advice is don't take ferrous sulfate. Take a much better absorbed form. It'll cost you another $15 a month or something like that, but it can really prevent a lot of problems that a low absorbable form of iron will cause or just not help you out with. And then detoxification. When I say detox or cleanse, a lot of times people come and they say, I want to do a cleanse this spring. I want to do a detox. I did one last year. And what they really did was they took herbal laxatives and they went to the bathroom a lot and they didn't feel so good, but they felt like, oh, you know, I cleansed or something like that. And that's not a detox. That's really not what we want to do. We want to make sure that on an ongoing basis, we're supporting our liver, our kidneys, our lungs, our lymphatic system. We're encouraging the body to get rid of all the things it doesn't want and doesn't need anymore. By doing a herbal laxative, you know, purge or a fast or things like that, for many people it's too aggressive, it's too hard, and it doesn't actually support those organs. It actually malnourishes you further. So we make sure that when we're doing some detoxification, we're supporting the body systems, and we're doing it in a safe way that's actually helping you achieve your goals and not kind of fooling you and thinking, I must be detoxing because I went to the bathroom three times today. Now I want to move pardon me, to the world of intravenous infusions. And this is probably something new for a lot of people, the use of IV therapies for any kind of medical condition. But the IVs have four real main purposes, and they can be huge and really help people out, especially the more ill they are from a digestive disorder like celiac. Really great at helping to heal damaged tissue. The primary way to heal the villi is by going gluten-free and is by providing the oral supplementation, the glutamine, the omega-3 fatty acids. But for some people, there's such inflammation and damage in there that if we can go in immediately and do some intravenous infusions, get the vitamin C levels up, get some of the other vitamins and mineral levels up, we can really improve their overall well-being, their energy, and their ability to heal. So we really want to use that for healing damaged tissue. We bypass the whole digestive and absorptive system. If you can put all the good stuff you want in your mouth, but if it's not being digested and absorbed, it just goes right through you and out the other end. And with IVs, we can use high doses, and we can go straight into the system. We bypass the liver. Everything that you eat goes into your, once it goes through your intestines, it goes to the liver. The liver is the first place that it goes. And the liver has to make a decision. What do I do with it? Do I process it? Do I metabolize it? Do I just allow it to pass right through? So some nutrients will change. And when you do intravenous, you completely bypass that whole system. And you go direct to all the cells. And so within 10 to 30 seconds, all the nutrients that we use are ubiquitous in the system. And they're not only in the cells in your pinky toe, but they're in the villi, they're everywhere. The types of nutrients that we use with intravenous therapies, they're natural. We use vitamins, minerals, so all the water-soluble vitamins like vitamin C, the B complex, calcium, magnesium, trace minerals like zinc, vanadium, selenium, and so on. We also use amino acids like glutathione, and alpha-lipoic acid. And there's several others that we can use that we typically wouldn't with celiac, but with other conditions. And the last therapy that I want to talk about, you know, and just briefly, is acupuncture. Acupuncture by no means treats celiac disease. It's not going to change and mean that you can eat gluten again and stuff like that. But acupuncture, I think, is such a beautiful thing and can play a real great role in the whole recovery and wellness aspect. It really works on the overall energy. It increases blood flow. So when we do acupuncture over the abdomen or over the digestive points, we increase the amount of blood flow coming to the organs. And healing is dependent on blood flow. The more blood flow, the more fresh nutrients you can get to the area, the better the healing is going to be. So we can do that with the digestive system. We can relax the muscle and the fascia. A lot of times when there's digestive issues, just like pain issues, everything is tense and preventing proper blood flow. And not only is it tense here, but it tenses up your neck. So emotionally, you feel tense as well, too. So when we can relax these tissues, we get better blood flow, and we can also get stress relief from it. We can improve the way we detoxify by getting more blood flow to the kidneys and to the liver and moving lymphatic fluid as well. And then stress relief. It's a great thing when the stress levels start to go down. And when stress levels go down, the whole digestive system works better. You make more stomach acid. Your enzyme production is better. Peristalsis, which is the contraction of the intestines, starts to work better. So simple thing like decreasing the stress could have a huge impact on the way people digest and absorb their food. So I think acupuncture can really fit in as a complementary therapy to a gluten-free diet and to other supplementation as well, too. So in conclusion, how'd I do on time, by the way? Oh, I did all right. So in conclusion, I wanted to leave kind of four main points, four main ideas with everybody. Number one, I don't think celiac disease is black and white. And from what I've heard from the conference, that's what I'm hearing from everybody too. It's not a black and white issue. You have celiac, you don't. We're starting to recognize more and more that there's spectrums of sensitivity, of allergy, of the whole disorder package. So you could have allergies, intolerances, sensitivities, you could have celiac, but it's not a black and white world. And I think that that's a real empowering message. How many people here actually don't have celiac disease? Yeah, and that's typically what I've seen when I've done a number of talks with the Kelowna Celiac Association, and many members don't have celiac, but live a celiac lifestyle because it works for them. And I think that some of the tests that I've shown you today, and as we go further with this information, we're learning more and more, you know, why. It isn't a black and white world. Number two that I really want to encourage you all to do is get thorough testing. No matter, you know, where you're from, where you are, you should be able to get the thorough testing for food allergies, for IgG, IgA, IgE, to find out, are there other things going on? Because that's really, really important. Your healing will be limited to a certain level if you have other issues going on. So going gluten-free may not be the only prescription for yourself. Number three, optimal nutrition. You know, we should all do it, but especially if we have digestive disorders, we want to make sure that we're getting all the right stuff in. We're not eating a lot of junk and a lot of processed and additives and preservatives. I like to live, pardon me, by the 80-20 rule or 90-10 rule. 80-90% of the time you're eating optimal nutrition, and then every once in a while you go have a burger and fries. Gluten-free burger, right, and fries, but 90% of the time, you're eating optimal nutrition. I think that's super important. And the fourth thing is, for many people with celiac and with the non-celiac sensitivities, we need to heal the digestive tract. Just going gluten-free, just going wheat-free, often isn't quite enough. We need to do some more to heal and repair that system so that it happens as fast as possible. So I want to thank the Kelowna Celiac Association for having me. Thanks, Irene. Thanks, David. Oh, there you are. Yep. And thank the Canadian Association for inviting me. I'm very proud and happy to be the first ND, asked to be here. And I hope everyone enjoyed. I'm definitely open. I'll be here as long as there's questions. And I'd love to open the floor to questions. And if anyone does want to get a hold of me later on, by all means, send me an email. Give me a phone call. I am here in Kelowna, so anybody from Ontario will be on a three-hour time zone difference. And my practice is open to new patients as well, so anybody here in Kelowna who'd like to speak to me or have a consultation, please let me know. But thank you very much for your attention and time, everybody. Really appreciate it.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Barlow. This gives a whole new perspective to the proceedings over the last day. We have lots of time here, and I'm anticipating we may have some questions. So Irene, we're going to split the room here, so Irene will take the north end of the room. Go ahead, ma'am.
I live in Quebec, and I understand we have naturopaths there who are largely not naturopathic doctors, who are only beginning to get them. How do I tell the difference? I've got three questions, by the way. Is that okay?
Okay, I'll answer that one.
Yeah, okay.
Each province regulates their own healthcare system, and the province of Quebec is completely different in everything that they do, whether it's dentistry. If you're a dentist, you can practice in every province other than Quebec. You need a special license. So yeah, in Quebec, we call people who aren't naturopathic doctors, our designation is ND, we call them undies. So you're right, they could go to a weekend course, they could do online,
right,
and kind of call themselves naturopaths or things like that. So the best way to find out is to call the Canadian Association of Naturopathic Doctors, so that's the CAND,
yep,
and find out who is actually licensed, who has the qualifications.
And one can look them up online, I guess, to get a phone number.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Can you do this testing in Quebec?
You should be able to. Basically, this testing is done by a blood draw. You send the sample to whatever lab is doing it. So you definitely can. The lab I use in Vancouver, you can be a doctor in Montreal, send the kit from Montreal to Vancouver. There'll be other labs closer, but you could definitely do it. Absolutely.
Okay. The other question's a bit different. Do you ever use Immunocal when you're trying to rebuild digestive tracts?
I haven't heard of that before.
You're not? Okay. That's, no, I just wondered if you were. Thank you.
Okay, you bet.
We'll take the one from this side of the room if we can now. We'll go back and forth.
Hi, I like your presentation very much. I'm a little concerned with the IV fluids, and aren't you, like, how is that monitored? I would worry about toxicity levels, and how do you monitor that?
Mm-hmm. Well, we make sure everyone, as far as their GFR and, you know, AST, ALT, so the liver, kidney markers, we want to make sure there's no problems filtering, beforehand, and they're not having any issues like that. Typically, in our field, and it's not just naturopathic doctors doing this, there's many medical doctors, more so in the United States, doing intravenous therapies. So you typically would monitor, either get a baseline test before, and then maybe monitor a month into it or something like that. Toxicity, you're not really worried about. There's no real documentation of toxicity because you're using water-soluble nutrients,
okay,
that pass through the body. So very, very similar to if you took 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C orally, it'll go straight through you. What'll happen with vitamin C and magnesium, these are two good examples, is if you use something, pardon me, like a high dose of these orally, you'll actually induce diarrhea because it'll pull water into the intestinal system, whereas we can use them very safely intravenously and it'll go direct to the cells. So it's monitored, but the studies have shown, and over history have shown, we don't need to monitor a test, you know, every time that we're going on.
Okay.
There's no risk of toxicity with these nutrients.
Okay, and I mean, this is all evidence-based?
Yes.
Practice?
Yeah. Now, the body of evidence will, with specific reasons for doing intravenous therapy, will be higher or lower. There's hundreds of different intravenous cocktails that you can use for different conditions. So intravenous therapy in general is very evidence-based and researched. The use for each individual condition, that's where you might see more or less research behind it.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Yes. I have a question. What's the difference between naturopath and a homeopathic medicine, or is there any?
Definitely. Naturopathic medicine, we're licensed as naturopathic doctors, so you go to naturopathic medical school, and so just like I described at the very beginning. And homeopathy is typically something that is part of the curriculum. in naturopathic medicine. Some NDs will use homeopathy and some don't, whereas homeopathic doctors, they focus on homeopathy. And they'll also probably work with nutrition a little bit, but their regulation is different. Their education is different. The length of time is different. So it's a smaller field, and it's a subset, and so they are different, completely different things. Yeah.
Sorry, I had one here. Sorry.
Hi, Brian. I'm sorry, I'm going to ask you questions that relate to naturopathic doctors in Ontario. Mm-hmm. One of our concerns there is that it seems that naturopathic doctors tend to put everybody on a gluten-free diet just because they think it's a great idea, and also that they're using the stool testing as a way of diagnosing celiac disease, and we know that's a very poor kind of test and quite expensive. It's about $300. I'm getting a sense that things work differently in Ontario than in BC as far as what you're able to do. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question would be, how do we open that dialogue with the naturopathic community? Because if we have people going to a naturopathic doctor and saying, yes, I think I'm gluten-free, and then going on a gluten-free diet, and then that spoils the chances of good testing. How do we open that dialogue to get things working better?
Mm-hmm. Definitely, right now in Ontario, BC is in the forefront of integrative medicine and naturopathic medicine. In 2009, we got our privileges for prescriptions and lab referral rights. Many states in the U.S. have these rights as well. And now that, now that we're leading the way here in Canada and BC, all the other provinces, especially Alberta and Ontario, are in negotiations with their provincial governments for new legislature, and it's very, very close to happening. So the Ontario Association of Naturopathic Doctors would be who you'd want to speak with, and they're the association, and then their college as well too. You'd want to speak with them because this is an important time, because they're really on the cusp of having new legislation going through next year. And I think this would be a great time to speak with them about that. I'm not really familiar with doing stool testing for celiac disease. To me, that doesn't seem something that I would do. I'm not sure why they do it. And every province is a little bit different with how the doctors are trained and what they work with. But that's the association you'd want to speak with. Yeah.
Another question over here. What I want to know is, do you have a green drink that you recommend, not something that I got to make out of my garden?
I should have been more prepared to answer that one. I should have knew it was coming. I'm going to have to take a look because I don't remember off the top of my head what it is. So if I can get back to you,
yep.
And maybe I can post it on the Kelowna Celiac site so that everybody can see that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Don't you love getting stumped? You get a question you can't answer?
Maybe this is another one. thank you for your presentation this morning. It's very reasonable, which was something I was looking forward to. At the board level, we once invited a couple of naturopathic doctors from the college to speak to us informally over a lunch. And they talked about remission or cure of celiac disease. Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't heard of it. And I don't want to give the impression that all I do is celiac disease, or I'm completely immersed, in it. But no, I haven't. I don't have the thought of that either. I'm sure that that's something we all would love to be able to eat. Yeah. I think one of the things that holds my profession back is this type of stuff. And what holds us back sometimes is you have people practicing on the fringe who, make a lot of noise, and then it tarnishes the image of what's really going on. And especially in the last 10, 15 years, our profession is graduating more and more professional people. You know, I use the term integrative medicine, you know, and integrative healthcare more and more, because that's really what we do. And you know, for us, it's you get these old terms like a herb tosser, and you know, like if you're in a car accident, all you need to do is eat a salad and you'll recover and heal. You know, that's not naturopathic medicine. That's not integrative medicine. You know, like I said earlier, we're all in it to work for the patient. You know, whatever works. Whether it's a prescription, whether it's a surgery, whether it's, you know, nutrition, is really what we should be doing, and that's how we're educated. But we can't control the fringes of our profession sometimes. Well, there's lots of good research on, you know, 200 to 1,000 micrograms of chromium. Basically, chromium is a mineral, and chromium is used as a glucose tolerance factor. So it helps escort sugar into the cells. So with type 2 diabetes, you're having trouble getting sugar into the cells. That's why your blood sugar levels go up and your energy goes down and things like that, because you're not getting enough sugar in. So chromium is one of those factors that can help to bring that in. And so it's one thing that seems to be helpful. Exercise is another thing. When you exercise, that will open up the ability of sugar to come into the cells, and it'll bypass that glucose tolerance factor as well. But chromium is something that can be helpful. Yeah. No, I believe typically it's an ongoing support. Yeah.
I have a question over here. I've had the IgG allergy test, the food intolerance.
Where's the question?
Sorry, over here.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And, I was confused.
Just wondering how accurate those testings are. When I did my intolerance or food allergy test, 75 of them were severely elevated, and 67 were mildly elevated. Mm-hmm. So how accurate is it that I'm allergic to all those 75?
That's a great question. And that was an IgG test?
Yes.
Yeah. I'll get tests that come back, and they kind of look like that as well, too. So what we do is I talk to the lab, and we reanalyze the tests. And there's certain patterns that show up. And all the labs are starting to compile more, more and more data on what these patterns look like. So typically when something like that will show up, this is not an allergy to these foods. Most of those foods, you're probably showing elevated levels because of inflammatory damage or leaky gut syndrome, if you want to call it that. And now larger molecule or proteins are leaking through. So it looks like you're allergic to, you know, every vegetable that comes in, but you're not truly allergic. It's the fact that you're just not breaking food down, and there's so much inflammatory damage in the system. So I've had a number of patients where the test comes back and you're like, oh, they can't be allergic to all this stuff. This is not right. And as we go further down the line, we figure out that's exactly what's going on, and they're able to eat these foods again. And I know that's something that isn't communicated sometimes. So you leave the office thinking, oh, I guess all that's left is apples and you know, almonds. That's all I can eat. Everything else I'm allergic to. But that's typically not true. Have you had the celiac testing and like IgE, IgA, all that type of stuff? Then what I would do is I would avoid the ones that we're most suspicious of, the most common ones, or the ones that were most elevated. So let's just say, for example, there was five there that we're really suspicious of, like eggs, wheat and gluten, corn, and I don't know, soy, let's say. Avoid those, disregard the other ones, and then retest 6 months, a year later, and odds are what we'll find is that not only are you feeling better, but the test will reveal a completely different result, because as the intestine heals, you're not going to have that type of immune response to the normal proteins that would leak through.
Yeah. I have a question over here. You acknowledged that the gold standard for diagnosing celiac disease was biopsy. At what point would you, as a naturopath, encourage someone to go and receive a biopsy?
Well, I do it quite often. The best scenario would be somebody who has been eating a wheat-containing or gluten-containing diet, and they come in, we do a food allergy test, and, oh, thank you, Bruce. So they're eating a normal diet, and what we say is, you know, we've done the testing, it looks like this is celiac, let's go and let's get that that biopsy, let's get the tissue transglutaminase, let's get the biopsy right away so that you don't have to go gluten, you don't go gluten-free for 6 months and then have to go back on gluten. I've had a number of patients where they've come in at different stages where they've been gluten-free for, you know, 2 years or something like that. And it's difficult to navigate through that. You know, you have to kind of put yourself in the patient's position, because on one level, at the end of the day, you know, you could be a little cynical and you could say, what does it matter what the test says? You know, when I eat gluten, I don't feel well, and when I avoid it, I feel good. Do I need a test or do I not? So patients they're balancing that themselves versus knowing that the true diagnosis is based on a biopsy. So, you know, what's the right way to go? So I just help patients with that information, and they make that decision for themselves. A lot of patients decide to go back on gluten and get the biopsy because they want to know for sure. They want to have a definitive diagnosis. So what I do as an ND is just really try and walk people through and you know, help them make that decision themselves. Does that help answer the... Mm-hmm. That would be the best way to go, but not everybody comes in at that time. And like I was saying earlier, you know, there's so many different philosophies. Some of my colleagues really do err on the side that, you know, everybody functions better being gluten-free, or, you know, everybody would be better to be away from it. And they don't see the harm, you know, in doing it that way. And some patients, that's how they feel. You know, they've already made their mind up and they want to come in and have a test run. But you know, the tests aren't accurate unless you've been exposed recently. So it's difficult to navigate, definitely.
Hi, yeah, thanks for a great presentation. I just wanted to clarify about the IgG tests that we've already talked about a little bit. But what my question is, are they ever actually just used to diagnose, or is there always a food elimination and challenge involved? And then I guess the other part is, what's your follow-up process with this?
Basically the way I use it, and I believe the way the IgG test is used by almost everybody, is you don't change the diet beforehand. Basically, on a first or second visit, we'll say, we think we should run a food allergy test, and let's not change anything. Let's do the blood draw, you know, tomorrow or next week or something like that, and then get the results back and see. So before you make any changes, you get that baseline test. So that's how I use it, and I think that's the way everybody would use it as well. And what was the second part? Sorry.
So once an IgG comes back very positive, mm-hmm. do you advise that person that they're allergic to it, or do you do a trial?
typically what we do is, depending on the pattern, like the first test that I showed where only one thing showed up, most tests come back and they'll show one or two or, you know, three, like something very manageable, that there's a reaction going on. So I make sure that I'm very clear with the definition of allergy, because I know there's a lot of, this is a controversial subject, absolutely. You know, the allergists, for the most part here in Canada, will say IgG is not an allergy. It is something different. It's a sensitivity. There's a real gray area as to what is an allergy, what's a sensitivity. And some allergists will only recognize histamine and IgE as a true allergy. So I try and educate the patient on, you know, what this actually is. This is a type 2 delayed sensitivity reaction, which I consider to be an allergy because it's an immune response. And this may be a lifelong issue, or it may be situational. I've definitely seen elevations in IgG because of overconsumption. And so when you eat the food every single day or 5 days a week or something for years, you might have this elevation. We go off of the food for, let's say, 3 to 4 months, allow the immune system to turn over. Then we can either retest, or typically what we'll do is we'll challenge. We'll introduce the food back in, and we'll watch the person get better. 4 months later, we reintroduce the food, and we'll find out then, can they tolerate it or can they not? So either a reintroduction afterwards or a food allergy test afterwards to confirm, you know, where we're at.
On the lakeside, Irene, do you have one there?
I'm in BC, and I was just wondering, here is naturopathic medicine visits and also the food testing, are they covered by MSP?
Unfortunately, they're typically not. In British Columbia, if you're on income assistance, so low income, they will cover a portion of 10 visits, but they don't cover any testing, unfortunately. So for the most part, it's pay out of pocket, but most of my patients have extended benefits through Blue Cross or through their work insurance. So, and most insurance packages, if you have dental insurance, and this would probably be any province in Canada, if you have any level of dental insurance or massage or chiropractic, you'll most likely have naturopathic as well, and that's how most people will pay for the cost or supplement the cost of these visits.
And that would cover the food testing as well?
Most of the time it doesn't. Mostly it's for visits, and then the food testing is totally out of pocket.
And can you give us a ballpark figure about how
much? Yeah, this type of testing really should cost anywhere between $300 to $400. Yeah, so if there's ever any testing, it's $1,000 or something like that. Be suspicious. It shouldn't be that high. It should be more in that $300 to $400 range, depending on how many foods were tested, you know, how big the panel is.
Thank you.
You bet.
Brent, I'm over here. I'm a member of the Professional Advisory Board, and I have two questions for you. One I think is simple, one I think is going to be a little more difficult. One, how can we educate other naturopaths to screen for celiac disease before they recommend the gluten-free diet? What's the best avenue for the professional advisory board?
I think every year each province has their own convention, and every year we also have the Canadian convention and the American convention as well. So to propose that we put on a seminar at these conventions would be the best way, because then you'd have a gathering of several hundred to several thousand NDs at these events. So the British Columbia Naturopathic Association has their annual convention in September, and I think they do it every September, October. So to line something like that up would educate almost every ND in the province, and to go through the College of Naturopathic Physicians to put out either a statement or to put out the information to go to all the offices would be the way to go, especially in this province, and then do that province by province and state by state. I think that would be an excellent way to go. And I'm sure they would be very open to having a talk on that at the conventions.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
So my second question...
I don't take difficult questions, I'm sorry.
My second question, I thought your talk was actually very balanced, except I do have some trouble with the intravenous therapy. And my question is, with my little pocket computer here, I'm able to search the medical literature, and I just searched the medical literature for celiac disease and intravenous therapy and each one of your nutrients. And in the medical literature, which is PubMed, there's no evidence.
Yep.
So where does the evidence for that come from? And where do I look for it?
I think that there's definitely a lot of empirical evidence. I think that when you go to some of the clinics, especially down in the States, when you go to the like Andrew Weil Clinic, you'll be able to get some of that evidence that way. I'll have to compile. I just couldn't tell you right off the top of my head where you would find that. But that's often one of the things on PubMed, which is the main site for searching for medical literature, you know, on studies. There isn't a lot of that, you know, randomized controlled trial studies. And part of the problem, like what I was mentioning earlier about intravenous therapies, is that there's a body of knowledge on the use of intravenous, but when you dial it down to the specific conditions, that's where you get less and less evidence and research on it. So, yeah, I definitely want to clarify, not to say that it treats celiac disease or that it'll reverse it or anything like that. And I'm sure that didn't come across that way. But in the ability to bypass the faulty digestion and absorption, bypass the liver, bypass or bring nutrients directly to all the cells, there is good evidence and research behind that. I just don't have that right here to tell you. Yeah.
Irene, do you, thank you. Over to the to your right.
Okay. Thank you very much for your presentation, Dr. Barlow, and for your perspective. I have a question. In your presentation, you had suggested that for GI rebuilding, you would suggest supplements of glutamine, essential fatty acids, omega-3 fats, and vitamin C and probiotics. Now, my question is how much you're suggesting to, I'm assuming you're thinking of supplementing the diet?
Yes.
With those things? Okay, so how much, in what quantity, and for how long? And can you not just get these, at least glutamine, essential fat, omega-3 fat, and vitamin C from your diet, just from natural food that these compounds are much more bioavailable through?
Typically, you won't be able to get these nutrients in the levels that we're looking for. Glutamine. Glutamine is an amino acid, so it's in all proteins. So you have chicken. You have let's say some whey protein. There's going to be glutamine in there. But the therapeutic dose is usually somewhere around 3 to 5 grams, 2 to 3 times a day. So somewhere around 10 grams a day of glutamine. So it's not possible to get that through food at that level of dose. And this is where the GI rebuilding and when you use supplements for these purposes, what you're really trying to do is go therapeutic. You're trying to repair as opposed to maintain. So to repair the system, that's what we're seeing for about a 3 to 6 month period for the glutamine. For fish oil or for omega-3 fatty acid, it's the EPA molecule that you want to have, and you want to have somewhere around 1 to 2 grams a day. And all these things are best in divided doses. If you take everything at one time, just once a day, it's very difficult for your system to process. A lot of it will just be lost, so usually 2 or 3 doses a day. The probiotic, typically we're looking at least 30 billion organisms a day to have a therapeutic effect. So typically, 10 or 15 billion 3 times a day. I know some people use much higher dosages. And the fourth one, vitamin C. Yeah, that is such a wide range because vitamin C, I feel like almost everything I'm talking about is controversial. Vitamin C is controversial. The Linus Pauling, the man most associated with vitamin C, was taking 15 grams a day, and vitamin C is one of those water-soluble nutrients where it's very, very non-toxic, unless you're extreme doses and for extreme long periods of time. So typically for me with vitamin C, I'll prescribe 1,000 milligrams 3 times a day, but I'm sure you would find a lot of people who would say 5,000 milligrams 3 times a day.
Well, just a comment about vitamin C supplementation. It does acidify the urine, so then if you are a renal stone former, you're entering another whole scenario.
Yep.
Anyways, I guess what I'm concerned about is that one, as a dietitian, we're always considering food first rather than supplements, and because the gluten-free diet is a bit more expensive, or maybe this celiac population here would say quite a bit more expensive, these supplements are not cheap. So that's just another concern of mine.
Mm-hmm. And I think the definition of supplement is really supplemental too, right? So I very much believe in what you're saying. We want to do as much as we can through nutrition and lifestyle, really the fundamental things first, and then we start saying, whenever that's not enough, then we supplement, whether that's a vitamin, mineral, whether it's a prescription, whatever it happens to be. We don't want to run to those things first. But definitely in our experience, it depends on what your goals are. Most people, who are diagnosed with celiac will go gluten-free and will feel much better, you know, much, much better. The subset of patients that come into my office and, you know, who I work with are not happy with how much better they're at, and they want to go to that next level. They want some aspect of their life back that hasn't returned just yet. And so do you need to take these supplements? I would say, no, absolutely not. You don't need to. But the people who come into my office, they're stuck at a level where there's more that needs to be done and more that they want to do.
Dr. Barlow, center back here.
You're first. Sorry. I got a simple question. You mentioned surgery, and I'm just wondering what you're taking out or what are you putting in?
I'm not a surgeon. I'm not taking anything out, putting it in. I think what I'm just trying to allude to there is that sometimes what can happen is we go down the path of there might be inflammatory bowel disease going on at the same time, so colostomy, you know, things like that. It's quite rare. I don't think that much of that's going on, but I think more and more in the past, when celiac wasn't being looked at, you know, how many people might have had some other kind of inflammatory bowel condition or had a procedure or surgery, gallbladder removed, when it was actually celiac disease that was the culprit for it or played a huge role in it. I've had, a number of patients who've had their gallbladders removed and can't remember exactly why they had them removed, other than just digestion wasn't very good. So that's kind of what I was alluding to. Not that there's any specific surgery for celiac disease.
Dr. Barlow, we're down to our last two or three questions, or okay. We're going to be running over time. So we'll go over to the lakeside again.
Okay. Hi, Dr. Barlow. Thank you very much for your presentation. I had two maybe quick questions. The first is, do you give any advice about water consumption? You mentioned about the problem of the hydrochloric acid in the stomach, you know, not being adequate. Mm-hmm. And there's a question about whether people should, in fact, be drinking water before dinner or with the meals, which is diluting the hydrochloric acid, and I just wondered if you give your patients any advice.
Yeah, I think you should only drink water when you're in front of 150 people, and typically before meals, the more water you drink will dilute the stomach acid. There's limits as to how much. You'd have to drink a lot of water to, you know, from a biochemical perspective, to really dilute. So it's a bit more theoretical than practical, but in general, it's not a good thing to have a liter of water right before you eat. What's best with water is to spread it through the day, stay pre-hydrated, just like eating, you know, eating every 2 to 4 hours, small meals, snacks, not these big quantities. So, you know, we typically recommend around, a liter and a half, 2 liters of water, pardon me, per day. But not at one time, not at three times in the day, where you're getting it kind of spread throughout the day. So before meals, I would say you could definitely have some water, but I wouldn't be, you know, really having a lot with the meals.
Okay, my other question is maybe a quick question, but when you look at the list of all of these foods that are being determined, whether you're allergic or not, and you said you get that from one drop of blood?
Oh, no, not one drop of one blood test.
One
blood draw, yeah.
And how does this test all of these fruits, vegetables, meat, eggs? It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, it's called ELISA testing. And ELISA testing is one of the standard forms of testing. So basically, they take the blood sample and they extract the white blood cell population or some white blood cells. And in these little tiny dishes, they'll have a population of blood cells in all these dishes. And they'll also put in the food protein or the food into that and then measure the response. So it's done on a microscopic level, testing how white blood cells respond. So basically, when you see those numbers, you see the reds and the greens, and that's just a graphical presentation of what's actually happening. So how much immunoglobulin G or how much immunoglobulin E or immunoglobulin A are your white blood cells making in response to being exposed to this type of food? That's how it's done.
Just a question. As a consumer, where would I access evidence-based information on the supplements to make a decision whether I want to spend money on something that's evidence-based or something that's on the cutting edge that may not have enough evidence. Mm-hmm. And toxicity, because it is a costly diet, and to add extra supplementation on top, I want to know if it's evidence-based.
I'm just trying to think as a consumer, you know, as a physician, you would definitely, one place you'd go is PubMed. You would definitely speak to, whether it be manufacturers or labs, you speak to your governing body. As a consumer, you know, that's kind of, I think as a consumer, that's why you hire either medical doctor, naturopathic doctor, you hire somebody to you know, find that information for you. I think you kind of stumped me on that one as a consumer. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a couple texts out there that are, like, they're kind of heavy and they're more medical based, but Dr. Alan Gaby, he's a medical doctor, and he, I forget the name of the text that he wrote, but it's an amazing compilation of most of the evidence-based research on vitamins, minerals, amino acids. So if you search for Dr. Alan Gaby, G-A-B-Y, medical doctor, he's practices in the United States, and he's definitely been one of the more prominent on the forefront. So that would be something where it's all compiled into one text. And that came out a year and a half ago. Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, firmly believe in that. We want to be evidence-based, and we want to have good definitions of what evidence is. You know, not everything can be studied in randomized controlled trials, but they're the most effective for many types of things. And we also want to look at empirical evidence. And you're right, we do a disservice when we just say things and we don't have evidence base behind them. But we also do live in a world where it's difficult to fund the research and evidence too. So sometimes putting that stuff together can have a real time lag. And, you know, 10 years later after, you know, research, a body of research is kind of thought of and known, now it hits the clinical floor, you know, 10 years later. So how many people, you know, does that affect by delaying it? But then on the other side, if you speed through things too quick and you push, whether it's a supplement or medication, too quick, how many people get harmed because it happened too fast? That's that difficult balance.
Dr. Barlow, we have one more question over here. And do you have another one back there, Bruce?
I have a comment just at the end, but go ahead, Irene. Thanks.
Okay, and then that'll be it. We'll let you go.
I have actually two really quick questions. My first one is are artificial flavors, colors, additives, and sweeteners part of the testing?
No. I've never tested for them. For me, there's one reason to not test for them. We know these things aren't good. So even if the test said, you know, you don't have a problem with one of these colorings, you know, red dye number 8, you know, we still know that for many other reasons we shouldn't be eating, you know, those types of foods. So especially when you talk about people having to pay out of pocket for these types of tests, I don't think there'd be any real demand to test for additives and, you know, colorings and stuff like that, because at the end of the day there's so many reasons not to eat those artificial flavors.
Okay, thank you. And part two is I've taken 300 milligrams 2 times a day of ferrous gluconate for 30 years now, and my iron stores are not improving. So clearly, I may need to look at a better absorbing type of iron, and you mentioned that there are alternate forms.
Yeah, there's definitely a few others. Carbonyl iron is a pretty good form, and ferrous glycinate is another pretty decent form.
Thank you.
And typically, they will be prescribed in something like 30 milligrams 2 times a day. So a dose that kind of almost blows your mind compared to the 300 milligrams. How can you use, you know, 30 milligrams? Typically, we're going a little slower, and we're going over more course of time. and trying not to overload the digestive system.
Okay, thank you.
Hello there. I just want to, I have more of a comment than a question. And as I'm sitting in the back here, I feel kind of like you're on the hot seat. And as an observation, I'd just like to say that Western medicine, neuropathic medicine, Chinese medicine, whatever you want to believe in, I think every portion of it has some validity and a place in the treatment of celiac disease. And I think that we need to keep our minds open to everything and everything new and not close your minds, because it was not too long ago that Western medicine was taught, and I'm looking at the docs at the other end, that the brain had no ability to regenerate itself. And now we know that the brain has neuroplasticity. So let's keep our minds open and let's think about everything, and like you said, everything needs to work together as a whole.
Thank you.
On that note, we're going to sum it up, and this was tremendous. You get the gold star for the individual speaker who has solicited the greatest number of questions, Brent. We thank you very much, Dr. Barlow, for your time. Very insightful. I think this is a very, I've learned in the last 2 days, a very active lobbying organization, and they clearly had a message for you today, I think, to take back to your associations, and I expect they will heed your comment as well. Yeah. Do the same. So on their behalf, thanks so much.
Yeah, and thank you. And definitely, like I said, anyone who does want to contact me, if we want to try and line these things up with the association, you know, please do so, because I think this is so important for us to be integrated and work together. And where there's a deficiency in knowledge on one side, let's try and build that knowledge, you know, up and go from there. So thanks a lot for the opportunity, and come back to Kelowna soon, please. Thanks.